You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Dana Hoey. Dana, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you now? Where is your studio at the moment?
I'm in Kingston, New York. In my new studio, actually. I've had it for a year. And I got it to shoot in, because usually I shoot outside, and I wanted to work inside this year for my next show.
So let's talk about your next show. What is it that you're working on? I mean, to the extent that we can talk about it, what are you working on for that show or at the moment in your studio?
I've got four stainless steel sculptures hanging that are my set. I have a photo set. I made four. They're individuals, but they're identical metal people. And I use them for people to move around. It's like a dance / martial arts set. So I have I made them actually as sound, as instruments for someone to play with their sticks in an Indonesian martial art form called Kali. But since then, I've been using them for people to hit and move with. So my work in the 90s was directed staged fictional work. And this is also staged work, but the people have gotten more and more agency in what they do in my pictures. So now I find sort of movement professionals, and I document their movements in my studio.
Okay, so let me just take that apart a little bit. So, right, previously okay. Your work, which is, we're talking about, you know, photography, has been largely staged and in different environments that seem to have specific narratives to them. Isn't mm-hmm. it unusual that you're creating sculpture that's a set in itself, or have you done that before?
I've always made drawings, and it is unusual. I mean, they're flat, so I wouldn't call them terrifically three-dimensional. They really are instruments, but I've never. Is it unusual? It follows on a social practice work, so I wouldn't say that it's unusual in the sense that I don't have a very photographic type of photography. Like, I always am thinking of a scenario and then documenting in photos. It doesn't really matter what the scenario consists of. It could be a landscape, it could be an interior, or it could be a set with sculpture. So the consistent thing is that I use a camera to document it for the most part, but what's in the picture is completely an open zone. So for me, these needed to be sculptures because I needed a cipher for a human. I wanted to be able to photograph humans without having to always have them in the studio. So making them a sculpture sounds more complicated than it really is. They're just four blank people that are genderless and raceless and sort of a false standard. So that way, when I go to cast individuals, they look quite different than these cipher people.
Okay, so these cipher people, these are the sculptures, and they're kind of, are they? They look like people. They're sort of cutouts.
You see someone go to a shooting range, and they're shooting that person.
Right.
Like there's a figure. Yeah. They're sort of like that, except that they're jointed because. They're jointed. They have a head, torso, jointed arms, and jointed legs, all in diamond shape. So they look like sort of harlequin target people. Sort of hard to describe on the radio, I understand, but
that's okay. It's hard to describe all art on the radio.
That makes sense. You're used to this, okay?
Yeah, I'm used to this struggle, and I know it is one. So these sculptures are going to remain in your studio, and models will come in and interact with them?
Yes, I actually fabricated them for the outdoors at first. I hung them in my yard, and I had my one of my coaches, J.J. Russo, come and play them, and I recorded the sound, and then I liked them so much, I moved them inside. But they were started as outdoor sculptures. They're hanging from chains, and they move, so that the joint is so when you, say, if you take a stick and you hit the torso, then the arms swing around and the legs swing around, and there's a sound to them.
And how will they be used? How will you imagine this series developing?
Well, I had two twin brothers come in who are Muay Thai fighters, and I had them spar in and around them. So to compare the twin bodies with the four generic cipher bodies, I had a Greco-Roman wrestler come in, and he's the one that has handled them the most so far. He sort of showed where one would hold on the body in order to take down and make different holds. What else? I've had a world champion Guinness Book of World Records holding boxer, Alicia Slick Ashley, come in. She's the oldest world champion. She's won the world title twice at age 49 and 50, I believe. She's going to correct me if I get that wrong, but I had her shadow boxing amongst them. So there's sort of high-level movement professionals moving amongst the sculptures, and the sculptures are generic and inert, yet active if you hit them. So they're there to provide a foil for kind of incredible athletes and movement people moving in incredible ways. Shadow boxing is sort of sublimely beautiful, especially when done by this particular fighter. So
that's so interesting. That's such an interesting setup. So as your work, then, this will be a series, and it seems like it's going to be kind of an unusual series, right? People are going to look at these images, and I would imagine reading them won't be obvious. There are humans interacting with non-human, with the sculptures, and it must kind of ask questions, like, what's happening here?
I think so. In some ways, they'll be super clear. Like, they'll be super clear and in a way decorative, because the sculptures are metal and reflective, and there's shadow. I've cast shadows on the wall behind them. So they're freely decorative and engaging visually. There's nothing sort of dry about them. They're about the lyricism of the body and movement. So I think there's plenty to look at on the sort of basic fundamental level. Like, they're well-lit, well-executed photographs, but they're also, if you move from picture to picture, you'll do what people often do, which is compare bodies. And within each picture, you compare a body. Perhaps if there are two people, for example, the twins, you would compare the two twins' bodies, but you would also compare them to the so-called norm or standard of the sculptures, which will go throughout the images. So you could compare, large Greco-Roman wrestler to smaller Western boxer to dancer to, and everyone is of different age, different size, different race. So you'll probably do, you're invited to do what the pictures are about, which is that urge to compare people and create sort of false standards and so forth.
Well, now that's interesting. Okay, so that's what I mean. That's part of the narrative a bit, inviting people to compare people and developing their own false, or maybe false isn't quite the right word, but developing their own kind of connections and narratives to what they think is happening.
Yeah, it just replicates what one does in seeing sort of the outside of people. And I really kind of hit a wall with photographing people, because I just, first I started out with photographing sort of my friends and not realizing they were girls, sort of consumable projects in the 90s when I was a so-called Yale girl photographer. And then I've kind of worked through different ways of working with figures, and now I'm quite freely working with them, but I'm aware of the relentless consumptive nature of representation of people, like the relentless misinterpretation. So it's just a way to play with that, and in showing motion, it's a way to, even though it's stopped motion, it's a way to show sort of how figures and life evade form that way, or hopefully, anyway.
Well, I mean, it sounds almost like a nod to Muybridge or something, this very photographic idea of also movement and form and how and what that's about in almost cinematic terms. Is that a reach for me to say?
No, that's great. I did actually a small museum show in upstate New York with Cheryl and Marks Blackwood, where they were actually Muybridge movement studies. They were giant wall stickers of movement studies of mother and son fighters. So 100% that's true. I mean, yeah, I love them. And photography has, Sharkowski had this one essay about what is photographic, and it's the frame, the perspective that you choose to shoot from, one other thing that I forget, and then the ability to stop motion. The ability to stop motion is my favorite characteristic of photography. So even though I think about painting, sculpture, film, performance, all kinds of things, I don't. I do still always love that aspect of photography. Not just light, but the ability to stop motion is just my favorite. So, yeah, that's definitely the right choice. I mean, it's not a broken apart movement analysis so that you can see that all four feet of the horse are never off the ground. And that's a fascinating thing that Moybridge did. It's more a question of sort of representing that there is no representation possible.
And what do you mean by that exactly? Because that's interesting. But there's no representation possible, meaning what you see is a lie? Or what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of pretentious, I guess, when I put it like that. But, you know, I'm working with people who are artists of movement one way or the other. And they do that out of sort of joy and learning of form and kind of becoming masters of different forms and innovating within them. And then they take off their workout clothes and go out in the street and are perceived in whatever way one perceives a person. And I just love the freedom of how they exist as movement professionals outside of how you might interpret them as young white men or young black men or tall white women or like a smaller Middle Eastern woman or just all this kind of like so-called types. There's really no, you can look at them and make the assumptions that one might make in a bigoted or open-minded way, or you can just observe their skill and movement.
That's clear. And how many images will there be in this upcoming show, if you know at the moment, and also how large will it be? What's the size of these?
Well, you know, I proposed an entire scheme, and I'll probably like completely revolve it by the time the show comes around, but the Petzl's a huge Chelsea gallery, and so I was going to put a fight ring in the Petzl. Okay, this for me to have a sanctioned fight night in the back room, and then about 10 photos in the sort of second front room, which is equally big, and then in the very first room, like about 10 portraits. So 10 vertical portraits of the people I shoot. Maybe he thinks more like 8 humongous pictures of these movement studies, and I would present them as you would in the gym, so you can bump against them if you need to. And I'll probably
how big are these? How big is humongous? What does humongous mean?
Oh, not as big as you would sort of, not like Wernicke humongous, not the way that painters make huge institutional paintings sometimes, more like ideally like 8 foot wide by 6 foot. It's so big in there, you know.
That's the ideal scenario. Humongous. And which space
is
this?
Yeah, but it's small in Chelsea, though. What?
Where will that be shown in Chelsea?
Petzl.
Oh, Petzl, right. So
yeah.
That is a humongous space in there. It's an absolutely enormous space.
Yeah, so I try not to, like, I don't, like, compete with it, but you do have to. And it's not about making sort of the massive institutional artwork, per se. It's more about having the figures be somewhat close to life.
Hmm.
Or a little bit smaller.
And the fight ring. So there's actually going to be a fight ring, like a performance in the back of the gallery?
Yeah. I already talked to the American Kickboxing Association president, and I've got the documentation. I'll become a sanctioned fight promoter next January, and it'll be a sanctioned fight night. That's the scheme at the moment. Yep, ladies' fight night.
Well, that's pretty interesting, and a pretty interesting process to go through that you're a sanctioned promoter. So tell me a little bit more about that. Why have that in there? What's the idea of that? And I mean, like, personally, I don't watch fights. I think it is what it is, and I'm interested in your take on it. I understand the beauty of movements and so many films that have captured that well, but boxing really upsets me.
I would imagine
women boxing would upset me in another way. But obviously there's a huge crowd for that. Also, the art world is something different. How are you seeing it? Why is it there?
Well, I totally, I completely understand not liking it. I actually find Western boxing a little bit tougher to watch now just because it's so much directed at the head. But number one, I practice it. Number two, I've always had people fight in my pictures, so conflict generally conflict has been an ongoing theme in my work. So the idea of the ladies' fight night is it really just started as something as a directing technique. I used to have people to fight to relax for sort of natural-looking pictures, but then I took it up myself. It will actually be Muay Thai fighting, so there's many more targets than the head, if that might make it easier for you to watch. You're certainly invited. I don't expect you to come if you don't like it, though. But yeah, there are many more targets in kickboxing, particularly Thai kickboxing. You have the legs, the torso, and the head, not just the head and the torso.
I'd like to come and watch. I mean, I'd like to think I could come and watch. It's not that I'm so repulsed by fighting. I think, you know, I mean, as you're saying, and you are also a fighter, you practice it yourself. So it's a martial art, you know, there's a craft to it. But in the art world, of course, this means something different. Staged in a gallery, it's a completely different context, right? It's maybe people from the world of kickboxing will come, but how will the audience take it in? What do you expect the audience to be or take in from that? Because audiences in the art world, especially Chelsea, we're used to seeing other things. Petzl has put on a lot of shows where incredibly unusual performances that are often somehow interactive are staged. What do you think the art world audience is going to see this? Because it's really staged for them, right? Not for other fighters.
Well, number one, if you have a fight night, you will have people from gyms there. So the first wonderful thing is that you will have not just an art world crowd. You will have people from probably the tri-state area, I would assume, like, you know, Philadelphia, New Jersey, also Connecticut, the local gyms, people will come there. So that's one of the things I love about gyms is it's one of the only places in my life where you have people discussing politics who have come from different sides of the aisle, discussing like openly, sort of rudely, in a live form, not just online. So they're like all class, all race, all political belief zones, and I love that about them. So it would just be nice for me to have people who are used to that kind of open and productive conflict physically in the Chelsea space will just change the crowd. As far as what the art world, I mean, I can't really say what art world people will experience. I mean, in general, I would say like in teaching in art schools, for example, usually often artists are people who've been stuffed in lockers in school and don't really like fighting and are intimidated, and I totally understand that. It's not about threatening anyone at all, 100%, but it is about, for me, like a big beef that I have culturally at the moment is sort of my crowd, like the white female lack of ability to take criticism, and sort of, you know, I've written about this. I don't want to go on a diatribe about it, but I feel like it's a good example for how to learn. It's the ultimate example of learning how to take a blow, take criticism, learn from it, and respond. And I feel like culturally, that's the sort of terrific weakness of people in my kind of social group, the sort of white middle-class woman, and it's imperative that this sort of, you know, it's art, so it's not like I think people are literally going to learn from it, but I advance a symbolic paradigm. That's what I do as an artist, and so that's what I would do with this fight night. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, and I like that a lot, because that's very powerful and very interesting, the idea of what it means to kind of take a blow and keep going. I mean, critically, of course, artists understand that in the art world, the difficulty of taking a critical blow, but it's, in a way, as I'm reading what you're saying, it's not so dissimilar from a physical blow. You know, what does it mean to come back after that when, you know, the few physical blows I've gotten in my life are, it's not just physical. There's a whole physiological and psychological and emotional response when you're hit.
Yes, you have to learn how to get hit. There's embarrassment, then you want to sort of, you know, talk about it and figure out what went wrong, and you obviously can't do that bad if someone's going to throw something else at you. So it's like a process of learning how to speed up the accepting a blow and either returning or evading. So like the emotional process is very slow. For example, if you were in a verbal debate, you learn the skill of, if you're an attorney or if you're in a debate club, you learn the skill of sort of like hearing the counterpoint, coming back with another point and not really sort of dwelling on it. But if you're, for example, you sort of see it in art school, like if I go into someone's studio and I tell them, you know, X, Y, Z that are all negative, and the person sort of sees up, locks up and gets mad, cries, whatever. I mean, I'm not mean or anything, but that's my job. So, like, you sort of teach people how to get through that and, like, take what you like from what I've said, use it, don't use it, but not personal. You know, like, so physical combat is, like, a really, really lyrical, incredible form of that. Like, the most speeded up, the most under pressure that you could possibly be. If someone's trying to hit you, then you have to be, like, on sort of high level of conviction and grace to be able to respond. So that's one of the reasons I love it.
I love that. I'm so glad we talked about that. That seems so powerful. And does that connect at all with, which is something I wanted to ask you about, you went to Wesleyan and you got a BA in philosophy and not art, right? You went on to graduate school to study art. Why
yeah.
philosophy? And did that impact your art? Because, I mean, we're talking about things now that are really interesting, that have, you know, some of them philosophical foundations or other things. But yeah, why philosophy? I know this is a big question. And how that impacted your art. I'm interested in that transition from BA to then getting a master's in art from philosophy.
Oh, thanks for asking. Philosophy actually is like a biggest help to me as a when I teach, just because I can go in some studio and sort of look at what they're doing as an argument, break it down, and break it down really simply is just helpful. But it was aesthetics that I studied. It was political aesthetics, and so that my, you know, I just had, like a lot of people go into art, I had this feeling like, oh, this will be the free zone where I can really be idealistic. And it's not that all art is political, but for me, I don't want to run for office, for example, but I do have sort of intuitions and emotions that can be called political. And so political aesthetics, the development of sort of art as a political tool through the Frankfurt School, you know, and then forward to the present, whether it's possible or not, all those kinds of things are fascinating questions for me. So the obvious thing with my work is like the early influences, the Judith Butler notion of performativity, you are what you do. So that's why having a fight night at a gallery is sort of within that language of like, well, here is a proposition I'm advancing, like here are women being what they are doing, which is conflicting actively and dynamically. So that's why I think even though it's totally not direct action, practical, political work per se, it's advancing a paradigm. It is what I do. And so that comes from what I've read in philosophy. So, and then I don't know how else it affects me. I mean, I don't really read. I read. Fia Baxter Mellis has this sort of incredible reading list for when I teach at Bard. So I'll catch up then. But for the most part, I'm off in fiction and sports writing and what have you. It's a long time ago now that I studied philosophy. It's more like training, you know.
Right, right. Well, not unlike, you know, I mean, and you're still training as a fighter, is that what I would say?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As best I can. I mean, I'm not young, but as best I can. I just came from it there. That's why I was sort of glad you were talking about books, because I had to shift my thinking from, I was just hitting bags. I wasn't sparring or anything, but I still had to shift my thinking from that.
Right. So let me ask you that, to shift back to that. The last question, what are you reading at the moment?
Okay, so I just finished a book that is somewhat unrelated. We've been talking to what we have been talking about, but which is super useful in the sense of like expanding my range of what is possible in an art show, because I had a very clear picture of what I wanted to do. But then I read this book, The Hakawadi by Rabi Alameddine. I don't know how you say his name, even though it's a friend of mine, but have you read it?
No, I haven't.
So Rabi wrote this other book called An Unnecessary Woman, which is unbelievable. And then Hakawati is his sort of the, I believe, the book that he first started receiving awards for. And Hakawati is a storyteller. And this book is about, it's a combination of stories from the Arabian Nights and the history of a contemporary family from the, most specifically the 70s forward in Beirut, but also in Los Angeles. So it's just a really like a web, incredible web of historical, theatrical, and emotional stories. And I'm glad I saved it. I knew it was out there, and I hadn't read it for a while, and I saved it for travel. And it's helped me because now I'm back in the studio. I'm making 10-foot drawings to add to the show mix.
And let me just ask you, what are those drawings, those 10-foot drawings?
They're tracings of the sculptures that I'm shadowing. So if you throw the sculpture on, it's jointed, if you throw it on a giant piece of paper, it lands in a certain kind of way, and then I trace it, and I'm filling it in different ways. So.
And those will be exhibited as well?
I'm not sure. We'll see.
Well, I look forward to this show. Okay, that sounds really exciting. I hope to come to the events there as well. So thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate your time and wish you great luck and success on this next show.
Thank you for your wonderful questions. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.